Public Safety Committee will come to order. We have a quorum. I need a motion to approve the minutes of March 11th. Representative Simonson makes that motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. First, we're going to try to get done with all of these bills so we don't have to come back, although Ms. Taken-Holtze is going to try to find a room if we need it, so I don't want to rush things if there's any controversy over this bill, these bills. The first bill on the agenda is House File 2263. The chair will move the bill. Representative Halverson, you want to explain your bill and introduce your testifiers? One more before you begin. I forgot to announce to the Representative Cornish and to members, I'm going to change the 24-hour rule because of the because I couldn't even abide by it yesterday. So no, I'm changing it so you can now. It has to be an amendments have to be to us by 4:30 the prior day. Like just we have too much going on, and I think a little flexibility would be in order here. Okay, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will be
Representative Halverson, one more. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine.
When would they be posted, the of you?
As soon as we can.
Sounds good.
I'll get you something more definitive. Representative Halverson. He's over
there. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2263 deals with notice to sexual assault victims when they're receiving treatment in hospitals. The bill requires hospitals to provide a notice to sexual assault victims that contains information about their rights as crime victims, their payment obligations for the forensic sexual assault exam, and civil protective order options. And also to give information on other supportive resources for victims. It's important that we provide this information immediately following a crime so that victims can connect as quickly as possible with support services, with resources that can assist them in their both in their recovery and in their protection. And the bill also ensures that sexual assault victims will get this information when they're at the hospital. It also clarifies to the victim what essentially the county pays for in their exams. So with me today, I've got Susan Elwell from the Office of Justice Programs and Carolyn Palmer from the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and they can explain further.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Suzanne Elwell. I'm the director of the Crime Victim Justice Unit in the Office of Justice Programs, Department of Public Safety. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and thank you, Representative Halverson, for bringing this bill forward. Representative Halverson provided a great overview about the purpose of this bill, which is to provide information to victims at a critical time. The bill originated from conversations between the Office of Justice Programs and the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault about the many issues facing sexual assault victims who go to the hospital for forensic examinations and the needs of these victims after they leave the hospital. And it's clear it's vitally important that this information be given to these sexual assault victims at this time because many victims never report this crime to the police or are connected to important resources. This bill would ensure consistent and comprehensive information is provided to those victims. Not all hospitals have SANE nurses or specialized programs to assist these victims, and this would ensure some consistency and comprehensive information is provided. In addition, it would provide notice to those victims about their crime victim rights should they report this crime to law enforcement, including their right to reparations, which is financial compensation to these victims that can help with medical and counseling expenses, their right to participate in the prosecution process, and their right to confidential HIV testing should that offender be charged and convicted. The proposed notice would, we hope, reduce the confusion that these victims have about the payment for the forensic exams that we see. Finally, I want to note that this notice would be prepared by the Office of Justice Programs in consultation with the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, SANE nurses, and the hospitals to ensure that it's comprehensive and appropriate. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to Caroline Palmer for further testimony.
Ms. Palmer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Caroline Palmer. I'm the Law and Policy Manager at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. I'd like to really thank Suzanne Elwell and the Office of Justice Programs and the Department of Safety for bringing forward this bill. And also, thank you to Representative Halverson for being the chief author on the bill. So I'm here to testify in support of this bill based on experiences that we hear about in our office at MNCASA. We represent about 70 victim advocacy programs around the state, and they do a terrific job notifying victims about their rights and what they have available to them in the community. But we still find out that there are some victims out there that aren't aware of the services that are available to them. And as Suzanne Elwell mentioned, this is particularly true when the victim goes to the hospital, has decided not to report the crime, hasn't had any contact with law enforcement, maybe isn't even aware of an advocacy service that's available to them. If they had connected with law enforcement may have provided them with a card that gave them some information about their local advocacy program. Some hospitals do also bring in advocates, but not all do. And as Ms. Elwell mentioned, there are also sexual assault nurse examiners in some hospitals that may be able to provide this information. But when you get into greater Minnesota, there are fewer and fewer hospitals that actually have SANEs on staff. Also, as Ms. Elwell mentioned, there is confusion for victims around their payment obligations, and we're hoping that this notice can help clear that up. They do have concerns about their safety and privacy when they're considering getting these exams and what kind of payment obligations they might have. Again, if they have some sort of notice that they receive at the hospital, they can connect with professional advocacy services, and they can walk them through that process. So mainly what we see this notice as a another tool that we can use to assist victims during a really traumatic time. It's a tool that advocates can use to raise community awareness about the services that they can provide. And we think that this is something that will make a big difference for victims in the state. So we thank you for your attention and happy to answer any questions.
Questions of the witnesses. Representative Lohmer, please. You're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Halverson, I'm just wondering, have you heard anything from the Minnesota Hospital Association? Do they have any concerns about your bill?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lohmer, we heard from the Hospital Association quite late in the process, just last night, I believe. And there are just some points of clarification that I think we need to work on with the hospitals in terms of making sure that the requirements that the Attorney General's office has about discussing payments in emergency rooms, that we don't run afoul of those requirements. But I think that it's nothing that can't be worked through. So the fact that we heard from them rather late, we certainly are willing to continue to work to find those points of clarification. We haven't been able to reach the Attorney General's office at this stage. So.
Representative Lohmer, other questions? This bill is going to Health and Human Services policy, so I suspect if there's any outstanding issues with the hospitals, that will be worked out at the next committee stop. Any other questions? Good bill, Representative Halverson. Thank you to the testifiers. The chair will move that House File 2263 be referred to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson, you are next. Not here yet. Representative Kiefer. Representative Kiefer, welcome to your committee, and we have House File 1851 back for a second time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, three times the charm. We're working with all the stakeholders to try to make sure this is in a good form. I'm actually a proponent of this bill, Mr. Chair.
Need you to move the bill.
Okay, we're going to motion to have it possible inclusion.
Yeah, we're going to move this refer it to the Judiciary Committee. So.
Oh, okay. then I'll make a motion to move it to Judiciary.
Okay, very good. Go ahead.
I've been working on this bill for a long time with MnCASA, and I sure hope it'll get its fair hearing and be passed into law. A lot of times I look at a bill and I say, is it really necessary, and what are the unintended consequences? And I think the unintended consequences, if we don't pass this bill, is we're going to have more and more news stories that we've seen over the summer, like a gal that's an employee at Cub Food and continually gets harassed by someone in the parking lot, and the person harassing her, flashing or whatever, or touching her inappropriately, just keeps getting a slap on his hand. And these kinds of behaviors are called repeat fifth degree, and what we're looking at is enhancing the penalty for repeat fifth degree sex offenses. I think at this point, I would like to...
Kiefer, before we have your testimony, can we move your A1...
Oh, do we have an amendment? Okay, sorry, I didn't have it in front of me.
So
I will move the amendment, please.
Okay, Representative Kiefer moves the A1 amendment, and maybe you can explain it after we vote on it and get it in the form that you like. Any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. That motion prevails. Do you want to tell us what the, or one of your testifiers, what the amendment does?
We just kind of some technical things to make all stakeholders happy. Maybe, Aaron, do you want to speak to the amendment changes? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair,
welcome
members
to committee.
Of the committee, good morning. My name is Erin Kuster, and I'm a prosecutor in Goodhue County, located in Red Wing, Minnesota. And just to speak to the chair's question, this is the third time that I've appeared in front of this committee in support of this bill. I am embarrassed to say I don't know the number this time around, but I do support the bill. What happened is this committee has been supportive of the bill in the past in its original form. The Senate has had some questions, and we've been working hard in conference committee at the last session, as well as working hard off session, trying to resolve some of the concerns and address some of the questions that came out of the Senate Judiciary Committee. In an attempt to come together from the House and the Senate to enact this bill into law, we did try to make some compromises. In the intervening time since the bill was introduced in this House in May of 2013, we do think that we've made some progress. And so the amendments reflect the progress that were made since the last time this committee considered this bill. Does that address your question, Mr.
Yes, I guess I was looking for...
And I can refer to Carolyn Palmer from MnCASA to answer direct questions.
Mr. Chair, I can provide a little more technical detail
to
you. To build on what Ms. Kuster said, in response to some of the concerns raised last year, we've removed application of the felony enhancement to individuals who have a juvenile adjudication on their records. And this felony enhancement that we're talking about today will apply only to adult convictions. So I really want to be clear about that. We heard that there were many concerns about how this might impact juvenile offenders, and so we have made that change to the bill. We've also provided for a stay of not more than 6 years so that offenders have an opportunity to seek treatment and to have supervision in the system. We can talk a little bit more about that in a moment, but that is the purpose of that stay. We also have a 10-year look-back period provided for the enhancements, which is similar to what is provided for driving under the influence and domestic abuse-related crimes. And in addition to that, oh, sorry, go ahead.
And it went from third to second.
Right, and so we are looking at the second conviction being the repeat that would add that would become the felony enhancement.
Very good, Mr. Waltz. Can you tell us, based on the amendment, tell us what the fiscal implications are, I guess.
Mr. Chair and members, there was a fiscal note prepared for this bill last session. I can't tell whether the amendment would have a material impact on the fiscal note. Everyone had responded except for the Public Defense Board, so they may have some nominal costs, but the Department of Corrections assumed it would increase the inmate population slightly in 16 and 17 and asked for roughly $50,000 in next biennium to cover the cost of this bill, but nothing in the current biennium.
Thank you. And I think Representative Cornish and Representative Lesh and myself were on the conference committee last year when this thing hit a roadblock, but I do believe we've resolved the issues that I remember hearing at conference committee, especially about juvenile offenders, and that seemed to be the bulk of the concern. So I'm hoping that with the amendment we've resolved that. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kiefer, thank you for bringing this forward. I think it's a really good bill, just like Representative Halverson's. I sit on the Board of Sexual Assault Services up in Crow Wing County. Ms. Palmer, were you in a meeting up there recently with me?
Ms. Palmer.
And Ms. Tracy, and Mr. Tracy as well. Yeah. Thank you, Representative Chair. Chair Palmer, thank you. I'm still reeling from our short committee meetings yesterday. Ms. Palmer, Ms. Chair?
Representative Ward.
Yeah, he's really
contagious.
We do look a lot alike, Mr. Chair. Thank you. It's hard to tell us apart. Ms. Palmer, do you remember the discussion that we had in Crow Wing County about with law enforcement regarding if a adult perpetrator molests or touches a female victim versus a male victim, there's a significant difference in penalty, if I remember correctly, or not. Would this address some of our concerns that were raised at that meeting that we had up there? As I see it, it may help, but I want to get your opinion on that, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Palmer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, if I remember correctly about that discussion, and we have brought it to our Public Policy Committee, too, to start discussions, that really had more of an impact when we were looking at first, second, and third and fourth degree, but particularly first and second degree criminal sexual conduct. Mm-hmm. Since this is fifth degree, I mean, I guess potentially, because that's a precursor, a criminal sex conduct, fifth and fourth might be a precursor degree, it would be an issue, but our Public Policy Committee, when we discussed that, agreed that it's a topic that needs broader discussion.
Okay.
But we're not ready to address it yet this year because it actually is something that affects a number of different criminal sexual conduct statutes. But for this one directly today, I don't think we see a direct impact on that.
Ms. Chair, thank you. And I wish it would have helped us a little bit with that issue as well, but besides that, Representative Kiefer, I really support this and thank you for bringing it.
Other questions? Okay. Representative Kiefer, I think that you've really worked hard on this bill, and my thanks to MnCASA for sticking with it. These are, when we talk about a fifth degree anything, we always think of it as less than, and fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct can be very serious, and it's not something that should be minimized. It's not insignificant, inappropriate sexual behavior. It's also illegal, and this is I just think this is a good bill that's good for crime victims, and I'm glad you're bringing it forward. Representative Kiefer, do you have some closing comments?
Oh, I think you did very well, and I think MnCASA too, and I sure hope that we can close this up this session and get this on our books.
Okay, so if there's no further discussion or questions, Representative Kiefer will renew her motion that House File 1851 referred as amended to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Kiefer.
Thank you.
Thank you for the testifiers.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Does anyone want to speak for or against that bill?
After you vote.
I will. well, then I would have to, we'd have to make a motion to reconsider. Does anyone want to speak about the bill? I would move that we reconsider House File 1851. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Now, does anyone want to speak? Someone want to speak about the bill for or against? I thought I saw people getting up. Okay, my apologies then. All those in favor of the motion of Representative Kiefer signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? But passes again unanimously. Okay.
Oh, we got someone up there.
All right, let's go back to Representative Johnson. Are you here? No, he's not here. Then we will take Representative Winkler. Is he here?
He is.
Iruso.
Iruso.
Representative Iruso. House File 2142.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair will move House File 2142. And Representative Iruso, I think you also have an amendment to your bill.
Yes.
So the chair will move the 833 amendment. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment prevails. Representative Iruso, you want to explain your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You may recall we were actually here one time before. This is the victim notification bill. It provides for victims of domestic assault to obtain notification of the intended zip code and, as amended, the city that the offender intends to live at following release. The amendment happened after some discussions with the Department of Corrections to listen to their concerns, and they worked through the logistics of how that would happen. The amendment also deleted including crimes of violence, so now it's restricted just to the domestic assault, and it inserted a paragraph giving the DOC discretion to give notification after release instead of a requirement to continue doing so post-release. And it makes the effective date January 15th, 2015, not the default date, so then the DOC would have more time to implement the program. And I'll stand for any questions.
Mr. Waltz, do you want to just go review the fiscal note?
Mr. Chair, only one agency responded with a request for additional funds due to this bill. That was the Department of Corrections is asking for one position to deal with the notification and the victim advocacy, and they're requesting $70,000 annually beginning in 2015 for a position to handle those duties.
And Mr. Waltz, we're not, we'll have to... Well, we'll move the bill forward. We'll have to look at the money implications of it. But
thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Iruso, I assume you recall at the end of the last hearing, we were all talking about a general location of the offender. And it was, you know someone's zip code, which in my neighborhood is very different than up in Representative Ward's neighborhood. And you give a 55130 zip code on the east side of St. Paul, where we have probably many of these people are going to locate because there are at least five halfway houses in that zip code that I know of. So it's a different deal overall. But then at the end of the hearing, we heard that you're talking about a nine-digit zip code. Is that right, Representative Iruso?
Representative Iruso.
I'd like to refer to some help here.
Thanks. Welcome. Please state your name for the record.
Hello, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh, my name is Rebecca Moses. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. And yes, the intent of the legislation is to provide a nine-digit zip code as well as the city. It doesn't give an exact address, but it gives a general location.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Iruso.
And I looked that up in my case, in my suburban neighborhood. That nine-digit zip code gives me one side of my street.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we also heard testimony that in other cases you can determine which apartment building someone's in, or even a part of an apartment building. Is that right?
Representative Russo.
Yes. Excuse me, and I misspoke. I didn't mean one side. I meant one leg of my street before. Yes, in a large enough building, it would be a part of one building.
Okay.
Representative
Lush. And, Mr. Chair, you know, this committee has to balance the interests of victims of crime with the interests of someone who, at least under our laws, has paid their debt to society. And so this is one of those weird areas where, in some cases in law, we continue to impose certain requirements on the offender who has paid their debt than we do in other cases. And this is probably one of the less onerous ones. We're not telling someone that they have to register or something. To me, knowing a zip code gives a victim a balance, area of which stores not to shop at if they can help it, or which routes to work not to frequent if they don't have to, and it probably reaches that balance for me. When you get down to 9-digit though, that tips the scales. I really believe that is too much on a person who has at least purportedly paid their debt. So I know, Mr. Chair, that I'm uncomfortable with 9-digit. I probably could live with a 5-digit as far as passing the bill. And I don't see that in the amendment, but it wasn't raised because this information came up towards the end. But I just wanted to advise that I'll probably be offering that amendment if the chair brings this up in an omnibus finance bill.
Representative Lesh, we can have more discussion on it. I appreciate your concern about it. Seems to me, however, if you have been terrorized and assaulted and your abuser has been in prison, not even a county workhouse, that the severity of that domestic violence is fairly significant. And if I was a victim, I would want to have that information. I guess we can argue the 5-digit, what's the other one? 9-digit issue, but I'm totally comfortable with the amendment and the bill as it is. Representative Russo, I'd also like to hear from the Department of Corrections if they're here.
I would also like to point out that the provisions in the bill apply only while the person is still under the supervision of the Department of Corrections, not afterwards. So if they're released, they're released on parole. They're still under supervision.
Are there Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I sort of have to agree with Representative Lesh on this one. In the cities, you might get a street or an apartment building, but in the rural areas, it brings you right to your driveway, and you might be the only driveway on that stretch of road. Yes, they are still under the overview or under the probations or whatever, still doing their sentence. But I've also seen where the victim's family does retaliation against these people. So we do need to, and I understand what happens to these victims, and it's very bad, and it's what they went through is very serious. But we also need to understand that these people that have been released on probation, or the few left that we have that would be on parole, they are being monitored very closely through the probation's officer and the Department of Corrections. The victim should know a rough area of what city or area they're living in for their own safety. But we also have to look at the safety of the perpetrators. We do have a responsibility to do that as well. And by going with a 9-digit number, we can actually create some bigger issues down the road.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I would just like staff to clarify, because I don't see it in the amendment or in the bill. Ms. Perius.
Mr. Chair and members, currently the amendment just says zip code. I don't think it's clear whether it's 5 or 9-digit, so it may be useful to clarify that for the DOC.
Is there someone from the Department of Corrections that can add
Or Ms. Moses, do you want to tell us? Does it, is it the intent for nine digits?
Mr. Chair, we would be willing to continue to have conversations. We did want to point out that the bill, if the Department of Corrections has reason to believe that there would be retaliation, because we understand we don't want anybody to be hurt, then they can withhold the information.
Is that in the bill, Ms. Moses? Where?
Yes.
Where?
Mr. Chair, line 2.7 through 2.9.
Oh, I see it. I see it. Yeah, on 2.7, 2.9. Representative Johnson or Lesh, does that offer any comfort to you, and or no?
Well, Ms. Chair, some comfort. Also, Representative Urso's clarification, which was, of course, should have been obvious that while the offender is still on paper, it makes a difference to me. It's not continual after that. I'm still going to have to think about it, though. I still think that that's too close. I still think it should be five digits, but I'd like to time to consider it, because my understanding is that, are you going to lay this over for the omnibus bill, Ms. Chair, or what are you going to do?
I'm not sure, Representative Lesh, if we're going to have an omnibus policy bill, but it'll be in the omnibus bill, finance bill, because of the, well, it depends on what the department says about the money for the Department of Corrections. And it's going to your committee.
Well, problem solved, Mr. Chair.
Can I hear from the Can we hear from the department about the you're from the Department of Corrections?
Yes, yeah. I'm sorry. Could you just? I'm Lydia Newlin, N-E-W-L-I-N. I am the Director of Victim Services for the Department of Corrections.
Okay, and the you need a position to do this. I mean, isn't it being done on some limited basis
it
now?
It is. Mr. Chair, it is being done. Currently, we utilize Minnesota Choice to provide victim notification to individuals in the state of Minnesota who request to be notified about offender status. One of the issues that we have is that the we have a pretty liberal definition of victim in our statutes, and so anybody who asks to be notified about an offender's release, transfer, death, etc., we notify them. We don't have to verify that they are the victim of the offense. So we utilize Minnesota Choice right now to do that, which is an automated or a web-based victim notification system, and it's interfaced with our offender database. So that is what would be our task if this were to pass, is to have to amend or make some changes to that system so that it can accommodate a very specific notification to specific types of victims that are related to specific offenders.
Sean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think it's just beneficial for the committee, you know, at the county level, if we arrest somebody on a Friday night and it's a crime victim, we also fill out the crime victim notification form for when they're released from the county jail. That would give them the information upon that their release, so you know where they're released from in that instance as well. But I think that is a fair assessment on that, the nine versus five for that issue. But I think there, the question arose in the bill about the exemption, and so it's section two, I believe, subdivision three, and that was the Commissioner of Corrections or his designee reasonably believes that the disclosure of the zip code of the offender's residency creates a risk to the victim, offender, or public safety. So it's built into the bill.
I suppose this.
Mr. Chair, we would like to clarify that this bill only applies to victims of offenders who have been convicted of qualified domestic violence-related offenses between household and family members who have been incarcerated in a DOC facility. So the scope is very limited. We really wanted to start small and make sure that all of the logistics of a project like this work before expansion. So right now, this would only apply to DOC facilities.
Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair, members, in the last committee, actually one of my coworkers came to testify on the crime victim or the assessments that we do, the threat assessments for these victims, and this really helps them put together a good safety plan. So this is a very important bill for domestic violence victims, and if that's the piece that needs to be fixed, then this is, I think it's a pretty tight group of people, and it's a very, I please support the bill.
Representative Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we just heard, this is for the department, we just heard testimony that said this is going to be a very limited scope, very limited group of folks that are impacted. I heard Ms. Mose say we wanted to start small. So why does the department have to have a full-time position? I mean, you said it was web-based. I heard you say that the notification is web-based. I don't understand a $70,000 position to start small for the department that is a web-based program already. And I'm, you know, I know a little bit about technology, but you know, to me, it seems like a full-time $70,000 position on a bill that I think is very important is asking too much. Can you help me with that?
Ms. Newland.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, sometimes by limiting then and making a small number, it actually increases the workload. As I mentioned earlier, we provide everybody notification who asks for notification, so to develop that web-based system, we don't have to do any individual research on who's asking for notification, what the offenses are, or what the relationship between the victim and the offender are. Currently, the statutes that are, what is the QDVRO statutes include assault. So we have many, many, many offenders that are incarcerated in our system right now that are in there for assault. So this will require somebody, every time a victim requests notification, to literally do research on who the victim is, who the offender is, and whether or not they qualify under this statute.
Representative Ward.
And if I could just also...
Ms. Nula.
In addition to that... we have victims that contact us every single day by phone and may or may not use the victim notification system. So to have somebody that is able to answer those questions for those victims is going to be critical and then assist them in determining whether or not they are eligible for this notification.
I would just like to clarify that the current system that we're talking about, that's web-based, that applies to the broad range of crimes, is only notification of the fact of release. The difference is that this would also release this address information. And so that's why it's different from what's currently being done, and it requires the verification of the identity of the victim and so on in order to release that, because this is data that would otherwise be private data. So there's a difference between what's being currently done and what's proposed under this. That's what causes the extra work.
And Ms. Newland, can you also explain the difference in cost, if there is any, between a 5 and a 9-digit reference?
Mr. Chair, the cost right now is that we don't maintain the 9-digit zip code for offenders, and so there will be two things that will have to happen. One is that we will have to identify those for the offenders that we currently have in the system, which I believe are about 20,000. And then the second component is that our current offender database that we utilize to interface with the CHOICE database is not created to maintain that 9-digit zip code, and so those changes would have to be made.
Very good. We have several more questions. I didn't realize this was going to get quite this controversial. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question for the author, maybe. If we know, and people have suggested what a 9-digit zip code could do, why didn't we just ask for the exact address?
Representative Russo.
Can I defer to Ms. Moses?
Ms. Moses.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly. The reason that we didn't ask for the specific address were concerns about safety. And so what we wanted to give victims was general information, as specific as possible, but general information about the location of an offender. We know I sat with a victim who was beaten with a maul, lost part of her spleen and a kidney, and has 72 staples. And she couldn't find out the location of the offender. And so, again, we want to make sure that offenders are protected. We understand there are data privacy concerns, but we also want to make sure that that victim who has had control taken away from her because of a crime that he has been convicted of gets a little bit of control back in terms of knowing where he's going to be released to, not just the when.
Kelly. Mr. Chair, maybe just a follow-up for Ms. Newland is, what is currently public information on an offender?
Ms. Newland.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly, currently what we provide victims, which is public information, is we provide 60-day notice prior to release, we provide the name of the agent who will be supervising that offender, and we provide the conditions of release that the offender must abide by upon their release. We also provide transfer information, notice of death, and a notice of expiration from sentence.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It just seems like we're on a pretty fine line here between what we constitute should be public information and an exact address versus a 9-digit zip code. It just seems to be getting a little gray here, so just an observation.
Representative Lash.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make a comment in light of Representative Ward's question of Department of how they justify their fiscal note. This being the unsession, many of us have gone through proposals from many departments about repealing statutes that they're really not following anyway. And I find myself wondering aloud and curious as to how many of those unsession proposals resulted in a fiscal note when they were passed, whereby the department got funding for it. That they subsequently didn't use. I'm not calling that into question for the department today, but I think it's grist for the mill, food for thought, Mr. Chair. I'd like us to find that out when we're proceeding through the unsessioned bills, if there were fiscal notes from those when they were passed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll be doing that next week. So, Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two quick questions here. Just for clarification, once, if this goes through and this unfolds the way you'd like it to, how long will that how long will the 9-digit zip code be accessible? Is this, how long is your name on that list for that?
Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Potentially as long as you're still, as they say, on paper, until you're no longer under the control of the Department of Corrections, but the amendment provides for the Department of Corrections to have discretion about whether they continue to release that information after the release of the prisoner.
Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that clarification. So potentially it could be potentially indefinite as long as it's deemed that way? Potentially.
Representative Russo.
I am no expert on sentences. I mean, indefinitely would mean that someone is for life under supervision, and I don't know which crimes that would apply to.
Well, Ms. Newland, do you know, do you have the answer to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, it would be for as long as the offender is under supervision. And so for our offenders that are serving life sentences for first-degree murder, then it would be indefinite.
All right, thank you. And then one more quick question, Mr. Chair. The comments that Representative Johnson made, Brian, kind of got my wheels spinning here just a little bit, and I just wanted to make sure that I'm walking through a scenario in my mind here, and I just want to make sure that we have this put to rest. If you have a offender who goes and does this horrible thing, and we get a 9-digit zip code, because I do come from an area where a 9-digit zip code can pinpoint pretty much where you live. And you have a family who seeks retribution and retaliation. If that occurs, and the likelihood is, in my opinion, probable, given the human nature, would the state then be liable if there was some type of retribution or retaliation? I'm going to give you an example. Let's say if my family member was arrested and went through the process for one of these crimes. The victim's family chose to exact a pound of flesh, and they went ahead and did so. would I be able to sue, you know, and say, hey, look, this is how they found my family member or my family member who was the perpetrator, come back and say, look, this is how they found me. They wouldn't have found me if the state hadn't released this information. Therefore, would the state potentially be liable?
Ms. Berrios.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm not exactly sure. I think there may be official immunity if they did it in good faith, but I would need to research and get back to you with more information if that's what you would like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No more questions.
It is making another stop, so some of these are good questions. We can try to get answers to them by when it moves to civil law. Other questions? Representative Neuberger, Representative Schoen has left. All right, then. So, Representative Urusa, do you have any closing comments?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Considering the extent of the conversation over the specificity of the zip code, that's something we're going to take a look at before it gets to civil law, because knowing my colleagues on the civil law committee, I am sure that we would have a very robust conversation about that issue. So I would expect we're probably going to amend that before it gets there, or when it gets there, excuse me.
Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak for or against the bill? Okay, seeing none, the chair will move that House File 2142 as amended be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed. The motion prevails. Representative Johnson, are you here now? He is. Senator Johnson, welcome to the committee. The chair will move House File 2295. You want to explain the bill?
Mr. Chair, I believe you have a delete all amendment.
The chair will move the DE3 amendment. Any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It is out of concern about the safety of victims of domestic violence that I ask for your support for House File 2295, as amended. Last year, 37 Minnesotans lost their lives as a result of domestic violence. Two lived in my legislative district. In 2011, Minnesota district courts handled 27,288 domestic violence cases. In 2010, there were 929 victims of a violation of an order for protection or harassment restraining order. This bill will offer protection to victims of domestic abuse through GPS monitoring. It builds on a successful pilot project in Ramsey County. This bill will allow that project to continue. It will also allow other judicial districts to convene an advisory group to establish standards to implement similar programs. The advisory group must be comprised of important stakeholders, and you can see that description on lines 2.26 to 2.32 of the DE3 amendment. The bill establishes minimum standards that must be met in any judicial district, and I refer you to lines 2.33 to 3.8 of the document. I'll start by introducing John Choi, Ramsey County Attorney, who will explain the Ramsey County project.
Thank you. County Attorney Choi, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm very pleased to be here today in support of House File 2295. I also want to thank specifically Representative Clark Johnson, who is carrying this bill. And this is a very important bill for the state, but also for Ramsey County, because we've undertaken this pilot program, which I'll discuss a little bit, and we believe that it's worthy of continuation because we've had, I think, some preliminarily good results. We've also been working with respect to the language of this bill that's reflected in your delete all amendment with the Minnesota Coalition of Battered Women, and I believe that there is a letter of support in your packet, and I want to thank them for their involvement in this process. But back in November of 2012, the Ramsey County embarked on a pilot project under the authority that this legislature already gave to local communities to enact a pilot program to utilize GPS for the purpose of protecting victims in domestic violence situations. In Ramsey County, what we have done is essentially created a pilot program focused on pretrial situations. So in the situation where we have a domestic incident, when that case was processed through the first appearance, Project Remand, which is a nonprofit organization that runs our pretrial services, they will do an evaluation to determine whether or not someone is eligible for this GPS technology. But essentially how it works is that if it is appropriate, then a request is made, and the judge would order GPS, and I want to make this very clear, that we don't request it unless the victim wants it. And if you think about that, if a victim of domestic violence is so afraid that she believes that, or he believes that, this is necessary, I think it's very, very appropriate. And I think that's the one reason why I feel so strongly about this, is because we should do everything that we can when someone is fearful for their life or their safety, and they think that this will help them. We should try to use technology to accommodate and alleviate those fears that victims would have, and to keep them safe. Because at the end of the day, I think what we do in terms of our intervention with respect to domestic violence incidences, it's homicide prevention. And so when you start looking at it from that lens, this GPS technology can be an added layer of security. And we've gone through a number of issues to make sure that no one has a false sense of security. We actually have a protocol where we orientate the person who is the person who's accused of the crime, so they understand what they need to do with respect to the protocols, and then also the victim, so that they understand what the limitations of the technology are. But when in those appropriate cases, in those pretrial situations, when the alleged is waiting for a trial, I suppose they also have a choice as well, because they've got three options. They could stay in jail pending the trial, or they could agree to pay the bail and bail out, or they can agree to a conditional release. And in those cases where GPS is appropriate, this is an option for the defendant as well, because they have a choice. And so the way that the technology would work is that the order would have an exclusion zone and would instruct the defendant to stay away and not contact the victim. And in Ramsey County, I think we started out with a 5-mile exclusion zone, but because of the dense nature of our geography in Ramsey County, I think the exclusion zone is 3 miles or 4 miles now. It depends on the situation, but we've had some of those issues. But essentially, if the accused is anywhere within that exclusion zone, then what ends up happening is that the person with the ankle bracelet is notified that they should that they're potentially in violation of the order, and then also the victim, they also have a device, and we also and this technology is, I think, what I would describe as the Cadillac version, and this is what is prescribed in the Delete All Amendment. But the victim also has a device, and so they're notified in terms of the fact that the defendant is somewhere near them, and then essentially we use technology with respect to texting, cell phone. And then also they're instructed to call 911. So there's a number of things that will happen to protect those victims. And the preliminary results that we have found in Ramsey County, I think that it's too early to have rock-solid conclusions because we've had a limited number of people on the GPS. And that's one of the reasons why we'd like to continue with our pilot program, to be able to develop more information and also continue with what we're doing. But the early results, the preliminary results, is that with respect to compliance with the conditions of release in terms of not contacting the victim, and the perceptions of safety of the victim and the information that they get from the GPS technology, all of that is consistent with the reasons why we undertook this, because we actually did some research nationally to determine what was the experience in other jurisdictions, and all of them had a similar experience where basically they had better compliance with respect to those who had the ankle bracelet, a better feeling of safety, and just some assurances from this GPS technology, and also the failure to, or the rate in which people will appear in court, which is another part of this, That's also been much better than the comparison group. So preliminarily, in summary, we think that the preliminary results would support continuing on with our pilot program in Ramsey County, and I hope that the rest of the state should have an opportunity, if they so wish, to be able to start pilot programs just like we did in Ramsey County.
Mr. Choi, of the two defendants who were rearrested and charged with the violation, was it because of the GPS, or was it other? Were there other reasons for their arrest? It's such a small amount of people, it's difficult to make
it is.
To understand the research. But you had 12 defendants who were successful, 5 that weren't, and 2 were rearrested and charged with a violation of the no contact order.
Yeah,
was it because of the GPS that they were found, or were there other reasons for the other reasons that law enforcement detected?
I'm just Mary Pat. I don't know if you have an answer, but Mary Pat Maher is with Project Remand, who helped hold together this report. I don't know if you have an answer for that, but maybe we could pull up a chair. And
welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mary Pat Maher, and I am the executive director of Project Remand, which provides pretrial services for Ramsey County. And to answer your question, in both instances where the defendant was arrested for violating the no contact order, both of those victims did not have her device on her at the time of the arrest. So it appears that both victims decided to have voluntary contact with the defendant. In the first instance, the defendant was pulled over for a traffic matter, and the police ran his information through their system and discovered that he had a no-contact order, and the victim was in the car with the defendant at that time. So the defendant was arrested for violating the no-contact order. Right. In the second instance, the defendant and the victim were at a third party's house when the police executed a search warrant on that third party. The police ran all of the people's names through their system who were in the house and discovered that the defendant and the victim had a no-contact order, so that defendant was arrested for violating no-contact order.
So then the assumption that that it's successful, as the 12 defendants who have been successful, was that your assumption is because they had the GPS, they did not violate the order.
I think that's a fair assumption, yes.
And did you have any contact with the victims about whether they felt safer with their offender being on a GPS?
Mr. Chair, as part of our evaluation after the first year of the pilot, a research analyst from Ramsey County District Court contacted 7 victims who participated in the GPS pilot, and they all reported that they felt safe knowing that the defendant was on the GPS device.
One quick question about the cost here. Who bears the cost of the GPS?
The first option, Mr. Chair and members, is for the offender to pay, but in the event that they cannot, then we, the county, will pay for it. And we have thus far, as of this past week, we've expended about a little over $20,000 for this program.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question related mostly to that cost piece. Ms. Maher, do you also administer the alcohol monitoring program for Ramsey County?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh, yes, we do.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Maher, how much now? From my familiarity, that the onus of that is upon the accused, except when you get max bail of $12,000 for those cases we have of a second degree DWI or blowing over a .20, then there is a state subsidy. Am I correct in that understanding?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh,
Ms. Meyer.
Yes, a grant from the Department of Corrections which subsidizes some indigent defendants' alcohol monitoring fees.
Okay, and Ms. Chair, Ms. Maher, what is the cost per day for that monitoring for offenders, and what is the difference in the cost per day if they get help from that grant?
Ms. Maher.
Representative Lesh, the full monitoring fee is currently $11 a day. If a defendant qualifies for a public defender, he or she pays a reduced fee of $4 a day. So the grant would subsidize the remaining $7 a day.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, just a couple other questions. Inevitably, when I look at how this is administered, my familiarity with DWIs, for example, there's just an assumption that the defendants will partake of the alcohol monitoring program because no one wants to stay in jail. In some rare occasions, there are people that cannot afford anything. I mean, they have nothing, and so they just stay in jail. I have greater concerns with this because when someone gets a DWI, there's not the risk of them going back and once they get out of jail, visiting vengeance upon their accuser or their partner or the victim, which is very different. And I trust that that's been considered by County Attorney Choi in doing this. However, I expect that a lot more people are going to get out of jail, and the statistics that you have provided alleviate that. Do you expect that the fee that you describe, once this program ends and the county stops paying for it, because I'm sure you're not going to keep paying for it, that the fee will be comparable to what currently you charge for DWI?
Ms. Maher or County Attorney Choi?
Well, I think with respect to who pays for it, I mean, from a long-term perspective, we're not there yet. We want to develop more experience and really understand what the benefit is to the public and to the victims. And so I think one of the reasons why we want to continue with this pilot program is that we want to develop more experience with respect to the data to really, really fully understand that. But once we get to that point, that question about who pays, I mean, I think there's a lot of options, but I will tell you as the county attorney that if it's something that helps my constituents and the victims of domestic violence in my community, and if it's necessary, if the local government has to pay for it and to continue it because we had good outcomes, then we will try to figure out a way to do that. But at the same time, you also have other programs in which the legislature or state government is subsidizing these types of innovations or technology, and I think that should be on the table as well, but I think we cross that bridge when we get there.
Okay. This is going to another committee, Representative Lesh, too.
Okay.
We have four people on the one.
Between that, I'll just have one other question, Mr. Chair. Ms. Choi, is that $20,000 that you've spent on the program so far reallocated from the county board based upon their cost savings for not having to house people in the jail? Or how does that work?
Mr. Chair, members, the funding for this program comes directly from our forfeiture budget in the county attorney's office. And so those are discretionary funds that I think are available to the chief prosecutor without county board approval, although we disclose that information to the public. But the money that funds this is through forfeiture proceeds.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, the overall concept of this bill I really like. There's just a couple of points I'd like to make and a couple concerns. One question I would have is, talked about one of the requirements would be the victim to request the GPS. If a victim did not request it, would a judge be prohibited from using the GPS technology?
County Attorney Choi, or Representative Johnson, you know.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, there's a set of statewide standards that are minimum standards. And yes, the judge would not be able to order it without the victim agreeing to it.
Okay. That's correct, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, the other question, major concern I have comes back to with each judicial district making their own standards. I've been involved as a law enforcement officer dealing with many domestics. We have a lot of them that occur from people driving through or visiting in our community where they don't live there. With different standards in each judicial district, I think there's a problem with people not knowing how it works. The law officers that would have to respond in dealing with the issue if there's a violation would know the standards in their district, but not the standards in a different judicial district. I think it'd be much better, since Ramsey County already has some fairly good protocols in place, that it should be a statewide standard, so with these people moving all over, the same standard would apply no matter where they are.
Representative Johnson, I'm wondering also, is this going to Representative Hillstrom's committee, if that is something, Representative Johnson, you would consider, because I share that concern that we don't have consistent standards and that each judicial district will construct their own, even though they're getting advice from various entities. I share that concern. I'm wondering if that's something we can work on or if that could be included in the bill, that we would have state standards.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson and members, yes, I'm willing to consider that, but I do want to explain what our thinking is. This relates to geography. The geography is different in Ramsey County than it is in my county of Nicollet County, which would be different than it would be up in the North Forest. And so some of the protocols are going to be location-specific. The second thing that I feel is important, and I think is an underlying part of what this bill is about, in my region, we've had a lot of experience with specialty courts. And in Blue Earth County and Nicollet County, we've had a positive experience with specialty courts. And part of that experience is drawing together the community to work to solve remarkably complex situations. And I think there's value in drawing together the professionals and community members to address those challenges. And so that was a lot of the motivation that I had in focusing on judicial districts addressing it, those two issues.
Okay. We're going to we have three more people. We're going to try to get through and then get Representative Winkler's bill, then we don't have to come back if that works for people. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me, in the program that you've administered in Ramsey County, do you do some sort of a lethality assessment to determine whether or not people should be eligible to do this, even if the victim requests it? And did you have anyone that you declined to allow to participate in the program based on dangerousness or that assessment?
Ms. Maher.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, yes, we do two things. We do a risk assessment of the defendant. We complete something that's called a bail evaluation, which is a validated risk assessment instrument that predicts a defendant's likelihood for both failure to appear and pretrial rearrest. And then we also do a lethality assessment of the defendant. And there were some defendants who were eligible based on that first risk assessment score who we did not recommend for GPS based on the lethality assessment.
So Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then if you don't make the recommendation that they be eligible for it, would the court be allowed to still order you to have that person be on the GPS program?
Ms. Maher.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom. The court is certainly allowed to order something against our recommendation.
Thank you.
Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Johnson, I'm just looking at the DE3 amendment again, and I have a question on Section 2, Line 3.5. It says, promote policies and procedures that eliminate disproportionate impact adverse to underrepresented groups and populations. Can you just help me understand what that means?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lohmer, and again, that is one of the six minimum standards, the state standards that are built into the bill. It's the recognition that we're a state of many cultures and a state of many circumstances, and that would also include, in my opinion, socioeconomic circumstances that may demand a distinct response. And this gets to this judgment that's part of this sort of a program. So we would ask the judicial districts to take heed of distinct cultural factors that may make application of a program such as this in one community less applicable or need to be implemented a different way than it would be in another segment of our community. I think that can be done.
Representative Lohmer. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Caught me off guard. Quick question. I want to segue off of what Representative Lohmer had asked. When you talk about on line 3.5, to promote policies and procedures, who would be making those policies and setting up those procedures? This is kind of a nebulous word here. I mean, we're promoting policies created by...
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, I refer you to lines 2.26 through 2.32, which establishes the advisory group. And so that would be people, would include representatives from law enforcement, prosecutors, defense attorneys, et cetera, and crime victim organizations.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. The other question I had was, as we were listening to this earlier, some of the dialogue that was going back and forth here with Representative Lesch. So the defendant would try to pay for this program. If not, then the county would pick up the cost, correct?
County Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, that's the way that, as we just heard in testimony, that Ramsey County does it. I'm not so sure it's limited to that option. I can envision a situation where I live where there could be a community funds established for this. This is the sort of thing I do believe that where I live, the community will get engaged in a program like this and be supportive. I have a community testifier here that can kind of show to some of the extent that the community is deeply involved in domestic violence. This is a critical issue where I live, and it isn't only involving the county prosecutors and law enforcement. It's involving the larger community, the churches and the schools, social workers. There's a lot of people involved in this issue because it's a challenge that needs to be addressed. And so I think we'll see varied community responses, and I guess I would call upon Minnesota communities to see this as a priority, and I think people in Minnesota would step up to that.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Yeah. Chair. I'm not going to question the intent of what you're trying to do here, Representative. I believe that your motivations are good, but unfortunately there's a price tag attached to this, and at this point in the game we don't have a commitment, a solid commitment from these groups that are out there that you named. Right now this looks like an unfunded mandate. The state is going to force this to happen. I would ask, have you contacted like AMC, the Association of Minnesota Counties, as any of these official organizations that represent some of these groups that you just mentioned, have they been consulted in how they feel about paying for this program, should that be the case?
Representative Neuberger, I think this would be voluntary if counties did want to participate in this, but you bring up a good point, and I want Mr. Waltz to address the fiscal note. I think this would be voluntary if counties did want to participate in this, but I do. You bring up a good point, and I want Mr. Waltz to address the fiscal note, because if we aren't having the offender pay for it, someone does have to pay for it, and I'd like to believe all people would get together and contribute it wherever they're going to contribute, but that's not how the way things work. So, Mr. Waltz, can you explain the fiscal note?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Like I said, I'm not questioning the intent of what you're trying to do here, but what I'm trying to say is that if we go ahead and move forward with this and we create this and then we just hand it off to these counties or these other groups and say, here you go, pay for it, I think we might be in for a shock.
Mr. Wells.
Mr. Chair, members, DOC had expressed a concern to me about the bill not being specific as to who would pay for the cost of the GPS monitoring, whether it would be the offender or the supervising agent. Different counties do things differently. Some counties supervise all of the probation clients. Some there's a mix between the county and DOC, and others DOC is the supervising agent for all of the offenders. If it is not specific, I think DOC's preference is that the offender be asked to pay the costs first. If it is not specific and the cost falls back onto the supervising agent, DOC would like to be included and is asked to be included on the fiscal note and would incur a cost as to paying for those GPS monitoring of those individuals.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Johnson, maybe between now and the next stop you can work with the folks.
Mr. Chair, we can. I do direct the committee to line 3.4, whereby, again, in the planning and preparation for these programs, the courts would be directed to address the financial costs to the defendants and the victims. And so, again, that's part of the planning process. There's a structured planning process on this, but I will follow your advice.
Thank you, County Attorney Cianni. Closing.
I just want to reiterate that, Mr. Chair and members, that this is purely discretionary. No community has to do this. This just authorizes a process by which this could happen, and the legislature is enacting minimum standards that they would like to see happen if any community should undertake. What I would describe as an innovative way to protect victims of domestic violence. And so this does not require one person in this state or one community to do anything.
No, but a decision that the county made could affect the state if the supervision was from the Department of Corrections.
Correct, in those communities.
I'm sorry?
Correct, in those communities.
All right, very good. Representative Johnson, closing words. We're going to. Does anyone want to speak in favor or against the bill? Therefore, Representative Johnson, any closing comments?
I just a couple more minutes. One is I'm going to ask Jamie Erickson to come forward. He drove up from the Mankato, from Le Sueur, to testify, and he will be brief in his comments. Okay. I do also want to mention that Pat McDermott, the assistant Blue Earth County attorney, cannot be here today. There's a tragic situation in Mankato where two young people died from synthetic drugs that is quickly evolving into a significant criminal case. He asked me to share that he strongly supports the bill. Blue Earth County has effectively used GPS monitoring in other cases. The county has a great deal of experience working with the specialty courts. And if this bill passes, he indicated he would ask Judge Bradley Walker, the chief judge of the Fifth Judicial District, to convene the advisory group. But Jamie Erickson is here, and if he
come
could
on down,
testify,
Mr. Erickson,
that would be
real quickly. Representative Winkler, how long do you think your bill will take? We have a room reserved. I'd like to do it now if people could wait. Do you anticipate this taking long, or would you like to come back?
I think our presentation would be extremely brief. That's up to the committee how long it would take thereafter.
Can we wait? Want to not come back? Okay. Then, sir, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee and Mr. Johnson. My name is Jamie Erickson. Like Mr. Johnson said, I'm from southern Minnesota. I think this bill, with the modifications, it will give judges, prosecutors, the abused, and even the abusers more options. I travel around Minnesota and I've probably given about 30 domestic violence presentations on Jocelyn Bishop, MSU student from Mankato that was stabbed over 40 times in July of 2011. I see how domestic violence affects the families of the ones that are murdered and the ones that are also terrorized by their abusers. I helped a young woman recently from Le Sueur. She had broke up with a guy about 5 months prior, and he still continued to harass her and her kids, which weren't even his kids. I convinced her to go to OFP, Order of Protection, and he just assumed that this was a piece of paper he could still intimidate and harass. He followed her from Mankato because he knew where she worked, to New Prague, waited for about an hour, followed her to her safe house in Jordan, kidnapped her out of her garage. He's awaiting trial in Scott County right now for the kidnapping charge. I believe he had said that the GPS has a 4-mile radius. She would have been alerted if he was wearing this, or maybe he would have never even approached the situation. Ashley Sullivan and Chet, her stepdad, were murdered in a farmhouse in Louisville, Minnesota in 2010. Her abuser had been put in jail many times, each time getting out on a $500 bail. And she moved in with her mom and her stepdad, thinking that she was safe. He broke into a house in their house in 2010 and murdered her in front of her son, and also killed Chet, her stepdad, while trying to protect her. If he would have had this tracking device on, it might have deterred him from not doing that. We don't know for sure, because obviously we don't have that in place. So I just want to let you guys know that I think that this will save lives, even if it's just one life. I hear somebody, I can't remember who it was, asked about the cost. What is the cost of someone's life? So that's all I got to say.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony and for coming to the Capitol. Anyone else? Any further discussion? With seeing and hearing none, the chair would recommend that House File 2295, as amended, be referred to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Johnson, County Attorney Choi, and others. Representative Winkler, sorry about this, but I will move House File 1126. And you also have an amendment. I will move the... Do you have an amendment to the bill? We don't have the amendment in front of us. We'll get it quickly, though. Maybe you'd like to just explain the bill and.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 1126 was before this committee last session. This is essentially dealing with the problem of teenagers in school who have adults in positions of authority grooming them for a potential sexual assault after they are not officially in charge of them anymore. And when this bill was before the committee a year ago, there was a 24-month extension on the amount of time that had to go by before a position of authority could have sexual contact with an adolescent. The amendment, the A1 amendment, which I hope will be distributed, moves that from 24 months to 180 days. So it goes from 2 years to 6 months, essentially. And so with that, I think it addresses some of the concerns raised in this committee. And I also think that the bill as amended still can substantially address the concerns about these types of individuals and their actions on adolescents. And if you want to just give a very quick statement.
Ms. Palmer, and then can you also just maybe address a little bit further what the issues that came up last time we heard the bill are on the Romeo and Juliet kinds of discussions we had?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Caroline Palmer. I'm the Law and Policy Manager at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And just to address a couple of the issues very briefly that came up before, the first was, of course, the time frame of 24 months. We are fine with that being lowered to 180 days. And I think a couple of the main things that came up was, I think the first goal around the extension of the time frame we've pretty much addressed. But the second issue is another goal of the bill, and it describes who's in a position of authority at the school. What the bill says is that, namely, it's an employee, volunteer, or contractual service provider who has access to the student. The student is at least 13 but less than 18, and the actor is more than 48 months older than the student. And that 48 months age difference is really important. I went back and listened to some of the questions that came up in last year's hearing, and so one thing I heard was about that 2 year, 24 month age difference, or what if a student is working in a job at the school, like as a student aide. To be clear, that student is not an employee or volunteer contractor at the school. They wouldn't have the 48 month age difference. Let's say they're in high school together. So I think we're addressing that issue of peers who might be in that situation together. So hopefully that clarifies it as well. And so really those are the two things we address, but we're happy to answer any more questions that you might have.
Questions of Representative Winkler. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair
And Representative Winkler, I just want to say I support your bill. I think one of the cases might have originated in my area that had something to do with this was a coach, and he used that excuse and no longer a position of authority during the interim, and therefore I think led to quite a plea bargain where it might not have otherwise. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative
Winkler.
I was just going to also point out that according to the Department of Health, something like 17,000 children are victims of sexual assault every year. So while it may have been one case that you're thinking of in your particular district, I think that this is a very widespread phenomenon that often doesn't result in prosecution.
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, this bill, or a variation of it, was brought to me several times over the course of the past couple of years, and I raised some questions. Does this only apply to school district employees, only school district situations?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, actually, I would ask the testifier. It's my understanding that that's the case. I have to look at the bill.
Mr. Chair, it's kind of in two parts here. The first part that you're seeing, Representative Lesch, about position of authority in general, is anybody who's in a caregiving, parental type of role for a student. And then the second part of the bill deals with the schools.
Okay.
Mr. Lesch.
So with respect to the first part of the bill, if a person is working at the local Dairy Queen and has a manager and leaves that job, and that ends up meeting the manager at a party 6 months later and begins a relationship, is that manager then guilty of the crime under the proposed bill?
Ms. Palmer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, I'm going to ask Ms. Erin Kister from the Dubuque County Attorney's Office to handle that one.
Assistant County Attorney Kister.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lesch. No, under that set of facts, that would not qualify under the existing law, and nor would it qualify under the proposed bill as it stands before you. The set of facts that you provided is that you would have to assume a couple different things. You'd have to assume that that manager was more than 4 years older than the individual that subsequently they struck up a relationship. And at the time, currently, the law requires that the sexual acts have to occur while that person is still in the position of authority.
Okay. Thank you.
Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I support the bill, and wish you luck. Thanks, Representative Winkler.
Any other questions? And the chair will move the A. Does everyone have it? The chair will move the A1 amendment. Any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Now, Representative Winkler, any further questions, comments? Anyone from the audience wish to speak for or against the bill? Okay, then, any closing comments, Representative Winkler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I urge a yes vote.
So the chair would move that House File 1126 as amended be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. Before I take the vote, don't leave. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Say no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr.
I need to, if you just stay for 1 second, to I move that we reconsider House File 2295 as amended. It needs to go someplace else. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, that motion prevails. The motion now is that House File 2295 go to the Committee on Civil Law, and then it will go to Judiciary.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to let you all know that Civil Law is going to meet on Friday. We don't meet until next week, and so that's a way to keep the bill going, and we're all in agreement.
Okay, very good. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. We got done. Thank you, members. We are adjourned.